Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. I just finished talking with Barak Kushner about his book Slurp, A Social and Culinary History of Ramen, Japan's Favorite Noodle Soup. This was published with Global Oriental Press in 2012. Now, ramen is something that legions of students and late night eaters and drinkers are probably familiar with in its instant form, right? We've got our styrofoam container with dried crispy noodles inside that you add hot water to in a spice packet, and boom, instant, sort of nutritious, filling, cheap food right there. Those of us who are perhaps lucky enough to have traveled around Japan or sort of gone to noodle shops outside of Japan may be familiar with its sit-down, sort of freshly made version, the bowl of some sort of meat broth with noodles and toppings on top. Regardless of which form you are familiar with of this culinary item, what you'll find in this book, and this again comes out in the course of our conversation, is much, much, much more than merely a history of noodles or a history of a given individual food item. This is a book whose story spans many, many, many years and many local regional contexts. It's a story of the different ways that the possibility of even conceiving of a context in which you would eat alone, perhaps at night, outside of the home, could emerge in a particular place at a particular time. So this is a history of much, much more than simply noodles, much, much more than ramen, although fans of, or people who are sort of just interested in food history will find much here that's not only really interesting and specific to ramen as an object, both cultural and material, but also really funny. Kushner is very much a very lively and very fun historical writer, and parts of the book are really, really hilarious. And so if you're interested in not just a well-written and really interesting story that's very beautifully illustrated, but also a story written by someone who clearly enjoys what they're doing and has a lot of fun with it and thus makes the story really fun for the reader, then this is a book for you. It was really fun to talk with him about it, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Barak Kushner about his book Slurp! Exclamation point. So Slurp! Emphatically. A Social and Cultural History of Ramen, Japan's Favorite Noodle Soup. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Barak, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
So Barak, could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your background? What brought you to the field of modern Japanese history in general? And then we'll get to the topic of the book in particular. I know. The longer we spend in our field, right, the harder it is to answer that. But
that's right. The longer it was before. Initially, I think in university, I started with physics, and then I realized I wasn't a very good student, and I kind of slowly moved into French history because I found that a bit easier. And I was going to continue in European history, but I realized that one had to be very adept and have numerous European languages when competing with people who were born in France or Germany or Spain. And I had always wanted to see East Asia. So I guess a combination of fear of not being any good in European history and interest in seeing a part of the world that I had never been exposed to until about the age of 25 took me toward East Asia. And I just ended up in Japan first, because Tiananmen Square had happened and getting to China was a bit difficult in 1990. And then once you get to Japan, you get sucked in with the language and the history and the culture. It's very different. And as a guy from southern New Jersey, it was a world, a very different world, and full of food I didn't like and a language I didn't understand. And I found it a huge challenge. And I would say also probably another reason that many people might forget as academics is a lot of us have very large egos, even though we try to keep them in check. And I think being an Asianist is very good for someone with a big ego, because it deflates your ego constantly because you're always challenged with the language. and the background that you don't know. And that, you know, it's a challenge that never goes away. It was fun. And then there, I mean, we'll get onto this later on and kind of why specifically that took me into belatedly into ramen, but there is a connection there. And I think East Asian Studies is a career in many aspects, regardless of one does history or politics or science, that keeps giving. It's a field that's growing. We don't know much about it. Not a lot has been written in English, and that can be very exciting for someone starting out in a new career as well. And so the field seemed open. Opportunities were there. People along the way said, sure, why don't you come study with us? And they gave me scholarships, and that seemed to be kind of a neat way to go.
And I'll ask you about this in a couple of moments when we get there. But one of the really interesting things about the book, about the narrative and the methodology, is that you seem to be very careful to weave your own experiences and your own kind of not only ethnographic but also biographical experience with the various topics that kind of constellate around the central topic of ramen into this story. So this actually becomes a kind of set of issues or a set of questions that's not only about the biography of the author, sort of as author, but that also becomes a really interesting set of touchstones in the narrative.
Thanks. I think that's ultimately what happened. This was a difficult project for me to write. And I think I'm glad that you appreciated that angle. It did make it difficult with some publishers to pick up the book because of that very reason. I think there's a real divide in the market between kind of trade and academic. And in pure trade, you're often talking about yourself and a bit about the content. And in pure academic, putting oneself into the book is kind of seen as a no-no. So went through a number of iterations to get there, and along the way did not necessarily gain the approval of a number of publishers, but I'm pleased with the final product, and I'm happy to hear at least that you noted that aspect of it.
Right. So while we're here, why don't we just kind of stay here for a few minutes and stay with this set of issues as a kind of set of methodological decisions as well as decisions about narration. Now the book opens with your experience eating ramen, and it's the first of many, many personal accounts that are woven throughout the narrative, including, right. I mean, this really wonderful story midway through the book where you are at a temple and the head priest sort of narrates his own personal story to you.
Yes.
About, you know, eating rice at the house of a couple with a baby, and the couple sort of leaves momentarily, and the baby sort of toddles in, or the toddler toddles in, takes a spoon out of the rice bowl, sticks it in its diaper, and then puts it back into the rice bowl. So this is sort of a case, I mentioned this, of your narrating that character, that, or that person's narration of a personal story. So this really does seem to be a case of a really deliberate decision to integrate both anthropological / ethnographic and also kind of historical archival forms of narrative and forms of evidence and methodology into this book. So can you talk about that maybe as a way of bringing us into then ramen in particular, which we'll get to next. Can you talk about that as kind of a series of decisions? Why did you feel that was the way you wanted to tell this story, and what kinds of challenges or opportunities did that pose for you?
I'm not sure that it was in the beginning necessarily a specific choice for narrative. I mean, the voice from the beginning was always going to be one of not pure academic, a bit lighthearted. I mean, after all, the topic is ramen. Mm-hmm. If you over kind of emphasize academic aspects, I think you kind of lose focus on the topic right away. And food, obviously food can be theorized and can be made into a very pure and delicate academic topic. But because ramen interacts so much with material culture, society, culinary history, but more importantly, popular culture, I thought of this book as a potential, I'm not sure necessarily the ultimate price makes it purchasable by so many people, but I thought of it as a vehicle for getting in a wide discussion of Japan, Japanese society, and Japanese history. And to do that, I felt it would be important to weave parts of my own experience in there as someone who knew nothing about Japan, but also several other aspects of Japanese society. So one, how the Japanese see themselves through their own food, and that was with the various experiences, both with people I've met over the years and stories they've relayed to me, but also humor and another interest and love of mine, which is what's I guess considered Japanese stand-up or sit-down comedy, which is rakugo, where someone on stage tells a lot of funny stories. And when I started going to see rakugo performances, well, maybe about 16 years ago, I didn't understand them too much, but a lot of them are about food, and there's a lot of people kind of enacting eating on stage. And I thought, wow, this is really strange. I mean, you know, how often do we see comedians miming, or in this case, pantomiming, actually, because they're using sounds, eating on stage? And that took me into looking at that history. And there's a whole kind of combination of personal, the funny, the social aspects, the experiential aspects that seem to be able to be woven into a fabric that would relate the story of ramen, what this food is, why it's become so popular, and what it means to Japanese society. I think also at the end of the day, I had finished a book on Japanese wartime propaganda, and that was fairly depressing. And I had been interested long-term in looking more at Japanese comedy and humor. I'm always, I guess, you know, one could say I'm a frustrated comedian. I was good in university at performing on stage, but never writing my own material. And so I realized, well, this is not going to turn out as a career, because if you can't write your own comedy, it's not going to work. And I thought this would be an interesting way to kind of combine looking at what Japanese people felt was funny, because as someone who enjoys humor and enjoys jokes, and I did a lot of this kind of in France, and I was very interested in French comedy, for popular French comedy, for a while. When you come back to the States, and I have a very large family, and they'd all say, "Oh, tell us jokes from Japan," and you know they'd expect to hear kind of, you know, two samurai walking down the street kind of thing, and you say, "Well, they don't really have two guys walk into a bar, or why does the chicken cross the road?" kind of jokes. And then people say, "Oh, because the Japanese aren't funny," and you want to say, "Well, no, the Japanese actually are very funny, and people pay good money to go sit all day in these theaters where they have comedic performers." But the jokes don't necessarily translate. And I thought, aha, here is perhaps one step on the road to explaining Japanese humor. And I actually removed a lot of the more scandalous, humorous, buttock-slapping stories, as some of them were labeled, from the book, because it just didn't fit in. But there's a certain element I want to get in, kind of the joy and the humor of popular Japanese culture, not just from the 20th century, but from previous times as well. And then integrate one's own experience, because I think food allows one to add a personal viewpoint to the subject, and then it makes more sense perhaps to contemporary audiences.
So that's really interesting, because not only is the first chapter, which we'll actually get to in a moment, called Three Sages Walk Into a Restaurant,
yeah.
noodles, but also the final chapter before the conclusion actually features an interview that you did with a contemporary Japanese comedian. So
that's right.
So this is actually really interesting as a way to sort of trace that thread through this story, or trace that noodle, rather, through this story. And so, which brings us to noodles. So how the book itself, it's about many, many things, but the focus of the story here is on a particular kind of noodle soup. So not just noodles in general, but ramen in particular. What
right.
brought you here from the sort of larger topic you were working on, or set of topics around World War II Japanese propaganda? Why ramen, and why now?
Why ramen? Well, I hope you don't mind if I actually skip to a story in the back of the book to explain why ramen. And then there are several reasons. I think the first reason, and I write about this incident in toward the back of the book. So my first experience with ramen is not actually in that kind of monastery of noodledom that I described in the beginning. My first very a personal experience, sadly, is in a town in a building which no longer exists. It's in the town of Yamada was pretty close to being wiped out by the tsunami that came last year. And I had lived in this town, lived in the town for about a year. And it's a town in Iwate in the northeast of Japan. It's where I got my first job, where I was supposed to be teaching English. The job didn't turn out too well, but I spent a lot of time at a temple with a lovely Buddhist priest and his family, and I learned a lot from them. And occasionally, people at the Board of Education would kind of take pity on me and take me out, because I think what they failed to realize is I couldn't read anything, which means I couldn't read store signs to know if I was walking into a laundromat or a restaurant. I certainly couldn't read a menu, and I couldn't read any menu that wasn't really printed either. I mean, you know, if it was too flowery or whatnot, the menu wasn't possible. And so I kind of went hungry a lot of times unless I went to the temple to eat. But one night, somebody finally took me out after we had kind of had a heavy bout of drinking at the Board of Education for some festival that I barely understood at the time. And they took me to a building that I had walked by pretty much daily for several months, which had never been opened. And this really mystified me, because I thought, for a small town, how can there be some kind of business site that's not open? And this thing was never open, and there were no lights on. And I found it kind of intriguing. It was really weird. I mean, there weren't that many buildings in town. And finally, you know, 2 a.m. on this one night, we entered this establishment, and it turned out to be a ramen establishment. I learned that afterwards. I didn't really know what a ramen establishment was then. And I would have to say that we were all feeling pretty good. You know, it's pretty cold up in Iwate in the wintertime, and, you know, we had had quite a number of hours of fairly robust drinking. And I don't think, at least I don't remember at this point, if I'd ever had ramen before. But tucking into that hot bowl of steaming, delicious, meaty sauced noodles at kind of 2:30 in the morning after, you know, several hours. And you have to remember, kind of, you know, drinking with colleagues when you are basically illiterate in a foreign language is both entertaining but also exhausting, because you have to pay attention to what's going on. You can't just chat. And it was kind of getting like a vitamin shot in the arm. It was fantastically delicious. It warmed me up. I could have gone on for hours after that. I thought, this is great. You know, what is this? And they explained it was ramen. And I thought, do you only eat this fantastically delicious dish at 3 a.m. after you're completely inebriated? And it turned out, no, of course, you can eat it any time of the day. But for a while, I thought it was only something you could only get at this one shop. It was so magnificent. It was kind of, you know, finding a unicorn in one's garden or something. And that kind of started me on this, you know, what is this dish? What does it mean? It's so fantastically tasty and delicious. And, you know, the sad thing is, of course, that that store was wiped away by the huge wave and the fire, actually, that came into the town afterwards, as was the entire center of town. But that's kind of my first experience, at least, of tasting and seeing and understanding what ramen was. And after that experience, which was in the early 1990s, I studied in Japan for a while. But then I ended up traveling to mainland China for some study and touring on my own and teaching, and then to Taiwan. And I was struck by the vast variety of noodle soups in China, on one hand, that were completely different from what I had been experiencing, what I experienced in Japan. And then, of course, how people identified them, whether they were identified by province, whether they were identified by the way in which the noodle was boiled or pulled, or whether they were identified with Japan or with China. And I found that, you know, very intriguing. And again, yeah, I think you have to emphasize this is in the early 1990s when this first started. So there wasn't that much knowledge, at least for non-East Asians, about what East Asian food was. I'd certainly had Chinese food growing up, but I had never had Japanese food. And actually, to be honest, I detested Japanese food when I first got to Japan. I thought it was horrible. I didn't like fish. I certainly didn't like sushi or sashimi. And, you know, you kind of latch on to ramen because it's a meaty taste, something that you know. And, of course, I knew noodles. So we became fast friends. And I think in the background, there was always an interest in why people in Japan talked about food in a certain way as well. I remember staying at the temple, the mother or the wife of my friend for the first couple of days when I went over there for breakfast. It's a long story how I ended up eating all three meals there each day for a full year. I won't bore you with that, but she would cook me a hamburger and then a piece of bread. And I thought, okay, so, you know, you don't want to be rude. I took it. And in her mind, that's what Americans ate every day. It was kind of, you know, they were a bread culture. Bread was what the Japanese call shushoku, or the main kind of part of the meal, and meat. And then, you know, when the Japanese ate, and I didn't understand much of the conversations, but at the end of the meal, they'd always say, oh, we need a bowl of rice because we're Japanese. Japanese eat rice. And I was like, yeah, but Japanese eat hotcakes or pancakes and cereal and all sorts of other, yes, but we need rice. And over the years, I began to kind of be intrigued as how or why certain cultures identified themselves with certain patterns of eating that they seemed to think were racially or ethnically linked to themselves. And then traveling more around East Asia, why it was that that developed one place and not the other place, and really how that developed in Japan and what that meant. It's a place that had adopted a lot of Chinese culture, but also, of course, had supposedly westernized very much after the Meiji era.
Now, at least a couple of things you just mentioned really struck me as being really central to not just what's happening in this early part of the book, but throughout the book. I mean, you open the book with, or in the introduction at least, by taking an assumption that a lot of people might come to this topic with and posing it as a question, is ramen a Japanese food, right? And it right. turns out that that question itself is more important than any kind of answer we might give. And the answer is much more complicated and, you know, between 200 and 300 pages long and and really much more interesting, right, than you might think initially. But these questions of food and identity also take us into the first chapters of the book, in which one of the things that's happening in these first chapters, you're taking us through. So the book is roughly a chronological progression. As you, I think, mentioned earlier before we started the formal interview, it's a kind of long durée history of ramen. You start us off in antiquity, and the first chapters take us through so the 8th to the 12th centuries, the rise of Edo, and ultimately we get to early modernity and then Meiji. But in this early part of the book, one of the really interesting things that's happening is that you're showing the ways that we can sort of use this case study as a way to disaggregate assumptions that we have, not just about food and cultural identity, but also about what the coherence of an identity really means, and to sort of help us explode that. And so one of the ways that happens early in the book is that you show the early, and this becomes a pervasive phenomenon throughout the book, but the early history of noodles and breadstuffs in China. Now, throughout the book, and this is something that I'm mentioning now because you're talking about your own personal experience in Taiwan, sort of brings this up as an interesting issue for me. The narrative keeps coming back to the importance of China in the history of the development of various foodways in Japan, and especially in the history of the development of this noodle soup known as ramen. Now, a major arc of the book and a major narrative kind of turns on various points of transformation in this history where China is alternately embraced and then rejected and then embraced again as a kind of touchstone for identity. So can you talk a little bit about that, since it's such an important part of the book, the importance of China in this ongoing and sort of transforming study of foodways and ramen in Japan?
Thank you. I think you've hit an interesting note, and that's exactly what I was trying to. Oh, this is what I learned, in a sense. I shouldn't say I, of course, knew this. I mean, if I knew it, there wouldn't been. There's no point in doing the research and writing the book. I think one of the elements that we tend to, obviously, Japanese historians and Japanologists were all well aware of the deep cultural and political debt that Japan historically has to China, as many countries around China's orbit have toward China. Of course, one of the things we forget is, of course, the debt that China has to Central Asia, to Mongolia, to other elements around it. But that's a secondary story. However, be that as it may, the Japanese tend to separate their food, their culinary history, from their relationship with China. And the Chinese do likewise. I mean, if you you kind of read diaries, mid to late 19th century diaries of Japanese traveling to China and Chinese traveling to Japan, they detest one another's food. There doesn't seem to be a lot of love there for the other. And so they seem rather convinced that there can be no relationship between their foods because they're so different and they focus on different aspects. And the Chinese are, of course, very proud of their own food culture. But as I began to dig into the one particular element of ramen, and ramen being born really from kind of a noodly relationship between China and Japan, I felt that I had to take a much longer approach. So as you mentioned, I mean, originally this book, years ago when I first started the research, was just going to be starting the 19th century story. And I guess partly being an historian, but partly wanting to know myself, I kept saying, well, what came before the 19th century? And I said, oh, I had to go back to kind of late Tokugawa, Bakumatsu, late Tokugawa era. And I thought, well, I have to go, you know, if I don't really understand what happened in the Tokugawa era, I have to go back. So it kind of kept taking me back and back and back. And things really seem to start off with this flat pancake noodle thing called Bing. And you find Bing all over China now. A lot of times it's a breakfast kind of flat pancake thing stuffed with very savory delicacies or just oiled on a pan. And it seemed that that kind of unrolled over time and became longer. And through various important interactions between China and Japan, mostly Buddhist priests traveling back and forth, a whole subculture of food technology and food tastes traveled mostly from China to Japan, and then, of course, around Japan. And that brings up the real interesting case of what happens within Japan. And I think as a modern historian, and this is probably just grew out of my own ignorance of pre-modern, early modern Japanese history, but I was rather struck over the years of research for this that there was a massive divide within Japan concerning taste and cuisine. And I think we tend to take for granted this kind of monolithic idea of what is Japanese cuisine today and forget about the big changes that came beforehand. And this forced me to kind of think about Japan in a different way, to think about Western Japan, the Japan that is much more in geographic proximity with China, and that would be Nagasaki. And, of course, not forgetting about Okinawa and that influence. And all the exchange that went back and forth there, and how food technology for milling and then for producing noodles and then for bringing in tastes and then for bringing in travelers and then students and then entrepreneurs who make these new tastes – all adds to this growth of eventually by the early 20th century, a new product that becomes much more identified with Japan than it does with China, even though if we look at all of the virtual elements of the dish, they've all in some manner or form originated in China.
And in fact, you're alluding to another couple of threads that are really, really important throughout this story. I mean, you sort of briefly mentioned, and I'll just tag it for listeners, because this is another really important thread throughout the book, the very strong Buddhist influence in the early history of cuisine in Japan, and that importance of Buddhist monks and Buddhist temples to this story is very, very striking, and that recurs throughout the book. But also the importance of these movements in creating a really interesting set of regional stories within this story. So the importance of local and regional histories to the emerging history and culture of foodways in Japan, especially ultimately ramen as part of that, is also a very powerful part of this story. Now, as we get into the book, one of the things that happens in the third and the fourth chapter is that we see the rise of the city of Edo and the urban culture that accompanied it, really transforming food cultures in early modern Japan. And in the third chapter, you also have a really wonderful discussion of the importance of Nagasaki to this story, and treaty ports also come in later on in the story. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of Edo and perhaps more broadly, the importance of the emergence of an urban culture to the story of what ultimately becomes ramen? And so in what ways is that important to the story that you're telling?
I'll start with the regional local with Nagasaki and then move into, I mean, the Nagasaki story is very interesting. I think historians, Japanese historians of Japan, this will be a story that's not very new. But I think for perhaps listeners or for readers who are more familiar with the slightly more monochromatic Japan that we describe in contemporary times, will be surprised to learn that Nagasaki was a much more international city in the 15th and 16th centuries, kind of the cusp after the Civil War, and then moving into the era just before the Tokugawa era in 1600. It's an international city. It's ruled in effect by kind of non-Japanese, and it's a major treaty port with China. And because of that, they have a very large population of Chinese that over time gets pushed into something called the Tojin Yashiki, or the Chinese kind of quarters, where they are somewhat quarantined while they're in Nagasaki. But even that quarantine seems to have been a bit porous. And they do a heavy trade in goods. There's a lot of Chinese tourists. And there are a lot of Japanese tourists going down to Nagasaki to see the Chinese and to eat the various foods, tempura, castella cake, pork, which generally speaking, Japanese at that time thought repellent, but the Chinese ate it a lot and some people kind of wanted to taste it. Now, this, of course, doesn't even get into the fact that the Spanish and the Brits are there in the beginning around Nagasaki. They get kicked out. And of course, the Dutch are there over the long term until the Meiji Restoration, and people go down to eat Dutch treats as well. So Nagasaki is kind of almost an amusement park for foreigners. And many Japanese flock there, not just to learn and study Western skills and Chinese skills, but also to see and experience. And this would include also the brothels, where some of the more scandalous among the Japanese want to go to the brothels where the Chinese have visited so they can learn stories about what the Chinese are doing in the evenings. And it's this interaction leads to creating a subgenre of Japanese cuisine, which is wholly unlike any other taste in the rest of Japan. This will ultimately feed into a pork-based ramen soup by the 20th century. But it's one of the reasons why different parts of Japan have different tastes that have attached themselves to ramen, because it's based on their own history and what those regions developed and who they developed in exchange with. So the Nagasaki experience kind of pulls into the rise of Edo, which is the shogun's capital during the 250 years of the Tokugawa era, and it becomes a massive city, the largest in the world, really, by the late 17th century. And urban culture becomes very important for the rise of noodle production in two ways. On one hand, strangely enough, soba becomes the noodle of choice for the Japanese, and one temple area, one monk in particular, is so popular at making it that his leadership bans him from further production of soba because it's not seen as pious, in a sense, for one monk to attain so much profit by selling soba. Soba becomes the dish of choice, but the manner in which the Edoites, the urban dwellers, eat, that they're not eating in the home, that they're paying money and eating at stands, that as the rise of urban areas throughout Japan along the trunk roads progresses, that Japanese can eat out of home and eat along these trunk roads becomes very important for the production of small entrepreneurs and people who will sell food items outside of the home to laborers and others who have available and extra cash. And so that urban market, the development of the urban market, the development of local tastes that people will want to purchase along the way when they travel, and the idea that one eats out of home and eats noodles. In this case, it's soba during the Tokugawa period. It'll be udon, really, in the south of Japan. But nonetheless, it's a noodly dish. That base of noodles eating out of the home and eating it at various stands and kind of portable stalls becomes extremely important as we move into the early 19th century.
Right. And as we move into the early 19th century and then the late 19th century in the book, one of the really interesting things that you're doing is you're kind of along the way pointing out what you characterize as four food revolutions in Japan. So as we come into the next chapter, you talk about sort of many characteristics of early modern history of food in Japan and noodles. And this highlights, or along the way, perhaps the first food revolution that you identify as highlighted. And you talk about a revolution emerging from the beginning of the Tokugawa era with growing markets for white rice for the upper classes. And this brings us into what you identify as the second food revolution, if we can sort of identify these in Japanese culinary history. And the second food revolution happened in the Meiji, as part of the Meiji Restoration. And that brings us to the middle of the book with this wonderful set of descriptions about the ways that ramen culture and food culture were kind of imbricated in lots of different aspects of societal and cultural change, coming along with a new kind of diplomatic identity, a new kind of kind of frame for international relations in Japan, a new military culture. And this revolution that you identify here is the rise of new imperial banquet styles during the Meiji Restoration. So this brings us into, again, this larger context that I'd love for you to talk about. You mention in this section of the book that the rise of a new Meiji imperial government starting in the late 19th century, I think 1868, creates a need for a national cuisine. So a kind of national cuisine emerges out of this, and in particular, this national cuisine that could be used in banquets to impress international guests. So can you talk a little bit about that, sort of the general issues of the emergence of this kind of national cuisine in the context of military and diplomatic transformations in the Meiji?
Yeah, this is one of the aspects that struck me. It's also one of the aspects that kind of frustrated me a bit, because I had requested several times to the Kunaicho, it's the Imperial Household Management Bureau, for a menu, for a set of menus, to show what the Japanese were eating and kind of how they depicted it on their menus in mid-Meiji. And they said, you know, no, we hold on to this stuff. And I said, come on, it's menus. You know, this is not classified material, but they wouldn't give it up. And the reason for that is it's this fascinating element that even until today, the Japanese imperial household doesn't officially serve Japanese food at its functions. It serves French food. And you know, I have this picture in the middle of the book of a menu that the Japanese had to transcribe, basically kind of from, so they took French dishes and then they transcribed them into phonetic Japanese katakana. But of course, no one understood that. So underneath that, they put them in classical Chinese, but that didn't make too much sense either. So then underneath that, they have to have an explanation of what it actually is in Japanese. And you're kind of looking at this menu going, well, what's going on? What happened? And essentially what it is it's not just Meiji Japan, interestingly enough. It's Bakumatsu Japan as well. Japan on the both sides, so the Tokugawa era Japan, late Tokugawa Japan, the shogun, his party, the Bakufu, are fighting for power in the late 1850s, and it's not quite sure if they're going to topple. Of course, the French, don't forget, support the Bakufu, and others like the British give their talents to the imperial side that wants to restore the emperor. But one of the things that Japan is struggling with now is how do its high-class officials meet other high-class officials from foreign countries. This is not a problem when Japan is essentially closed off. Now, there's been a lot of work recently talking about, yes, we know Japan was not completely closed off during the Tokugawa era. The Dutch were there. The Chinese were there. But if you look at the Japanese struggling with this issue in the 1850s and the 1860s, you realize that Edo was closed off. No one was meeting with the emperor. He was kind of, you know, tucked away in a chamber in Kyoto until 1868. And very few foreign officials, if any, ever got to meet with the shogun. So when foreign diplomats of a particularly high rank are coming to Japan after kind of 1854, the two big questions need to be answered. A, what are they going to eat? What are the Japanese going to serve them to eat? And who are they going to eat with? And this doesn't sound like a big problem, but when you look back at Commodore Perry's, the official logbook of Commodore Perry in 1853 and 1854, it's apparent on both sides that they detest each other's food. This is very similar to the Chinese example I gave before. The Americans are very impressed with the meal that they give on the USS Powhatan in 1854, and the Japanese write that they didn't like it, and the Americans were not impressed with the Japanese food that they felt was both not tasty, too fishy, and the portions were too small, although each side liked the fact that the other side gave copious amounts of alcohol. And so you can really see that this could potentially turn into either a way for the Japanese to smooth over international relations if they can get a grip on how to do it through banqueting and food. And when they travel for the first time in the late 1850s and early 1860s, they're treated to these sumptuous dinners throughout the U.S., throughout Europe. They're seated at tables with, oh gosh, women, and they have to chat, and it's all very foreign to them. So they quickly go through a whole routine of they go to Victorian London and they copy the imperial manuals, and it's very, I mean, down to the smallest points of how should the hat and coat and cane of a gentleman be taken at the door and where should they be placed. They talk about seating and protocol, and then of course they talk about menu and food. And at this point in time, in the mid 19th century, it's French food. It's French language for diplomacy, and it's French food, and the Japanese really have to quickly learn that diplomacy is not just about the language of unequal treaties and the language of law, but it is also, of course, about eating properly and the language of food and the language of banqueting. The interesting connection is therefore made at the same time with this idea of national cuisine and, of course, military culture. Because what do you call what you're eating? The Japanese really didn't necessarily have a word. There was no kind of specific terminology for nihonryori or, something. Dishes had names, but one's national cuisine didn't really, because it wasn't important. It wasn't really coming into conflict or into competition with anyone else's cuisine. And this isn't an issue if you don't have a standing military army. But once you have a nation that's bounded by specific boundaries and you are interacting with other national groups and you want to demonstrate that this is or is not your food, and you have a standing military that you need to feed, you begin to think a bit more differently about what they're eating. And that was the big connection, therefore, with military culture. Should the infantry be eating Japanese food? And if they were to eat Japanese food, what did that mean? Because different parts of Japan ate differently. And what they realized early on was that eating Japanese food didn't seem to give them the requisite calories and boost vitamins needed to become as big and strong as the Westerners they were coming into contact with at these banquets and in international exchanges. And that really scared them. And they begin to dig into this and talk about, well, are we small because that's what we've been eating? Are we weak? And are we being overrun by the West because what we eat is bad or insufficient? And there were a lot of arguments about it on both sides.
And now that the that image that you mention of the menu is one of many really beautiful and striking images throughout the book. There are a lot of images, some of them in full color. And so I tag that for listeners to be one more argument for buying the book, because it is really beautifully illustrated. And the names of these menu items being a really interesting part of the story also goes on to be important in really amusing ways through the book. I mean, there's sort of, as we see the emergence of food products named for military touchstones, you describe the sort of menu creations of items like Smash the Baltic Fleet Memorial Togo Marshmallow.
Oh, I'm glad you got that. That is my favorite food item, yes.
I love that.
It sounds tasty.
I want that on a t-shirt.
Yes.
What you just mentioned with the sort of the importance of an emerging military culture and sort of food concerns related to the military highlights the importance of some major emergence phenomena that you highlight here in the book, which are in this part of the book, one of which is the importance of meat eating and a sort of meat eating culture. The other being these related discourses of nutrition, as you mentioned, but also hygiene. And there are some really interesting moments in this chapter. I don't know if you want to take a moment to talk about this, where we're not just talking about food history in the context of what we're putting into the body, but also what's coming out of the body. And that becomes a location for interesting interweaving of kind of excrement and other kinds of things that come out of us throughout the story.
Yeah, this is one of those aspects that, again, we tend to forget as modernists with our super clean toilets. And of course, when we discuss Japan and toilets, everyone knows about the toilet spray and the heated toilet and the toilets that sing to you. So we tend to forget that in the mid and even into the early 20th century, these, of course, did not exist as an anathema in Japan, in a sense. So let me tie in the meat eating with that. One of the interesting aspects of the real change in the way Japanese eat is, of course, meat eating. Now, this doesn't deny that the Japanese ate meat over the long term. Of course, they always have. But it was frowned upon, and it was certainly frowned upon much more for both religious and political reasons in the upper classes. So for all intents and purposes, you have meat eating in Japan. It's just not that prevalent and not as much, of course, as one found in the West. And I give some interesting comparisons with the vast amounts of meat that Brits ate at various times throughout the centuries. And you know, if the Japanese compared themselves to other cultures, it wouldn't be as a grotesque discrepancy, but of course, compared to the British and the Germans, with whom they want to compare themselves as civilized nations in the 19th century, the gap is enormous. So what changes really at this point is that the Japanese feel that they need to, well, at least some Japanese feel, some public intellectuals feel that the Japanese need to change their eating habits to be big and strong like the West. And this is really where we begin to see the change that enables ramen to come onto the market in the 20th century. The noodle culture has been building, but it needs to marry with the meat culture, because ramen noodle soup is a meat-based soup of either chicken, pork, beef, or a combination. And the Japanese begin eating more of that. It's not too tasty to them, and people remark on it. They really don't like it. And people, sailors in the Navy talk about kind of their first experience getting beef curry, where they feel that it's kind of a grotesque mountain of some sort of excrement. But the other half of the excrement story, which I found compelling and wanted to include in these chapters, is that the Japanese themselves are considering and examining their own sort of excremental history. And they remark that they need to change. So on one hand, they begin to divorce themselves from the rest of East Asia in their minds by the way in which they evacuate themselves and by the way in which they kind of arrange their hygiene. They want to be seen as more hygienic and therefore not as they consider the Chinese to be dirty and backwards. And this becomes a very important motif really up until World War II. And they do this in comparison with the Koreans as well. They want to set themselves apart. And they do this, they start in the 1860s, but it continues up through the all the way until the early 20th century with a series of laws about where one can defecate or urinate in the street. And I include pictures because there's a cartoon version of this. Obviously not a lot of Japanese were illiterate. And they also, strangely at times, wax poetic about their the shape of their defecation compared with the shape and the sound and smell of defecation of Westerners with whom they would like to be placed on the same scale. And they also denigrate the smell and hygiene, therefore, of East Asia. And it's really compelling to read through some of the memoirs of travelers in Japanese travelers in Taiwan and China in the 19-teens and the 1920s, where they constantly, on one hand, partly remark on the delicious taste and variety of Chinese food, but then at the same time will denigrate the smells around them and that garlic is an overpowering stench that they can't get used to. So they really struggle with, in some ways, again, kind of their own, this is the next step perhaps in food diplomacy, they struggle with their own rather kind of uniform taste in Japan that's not as exciting as what they're finding around the rest of their expanding empire. But on the other hand, they want to keep a distance from it because they want to place themselves on top.
Now, how do we move from this story to ultimately the story that becomes embodied in the styrofoam cup of instant ramen? Now, we move here in a series of chapters that I'll kind of just highlight to make sure that we get to that styrofoam cup, because that's the context that I'm sure many listeners have encountered ramen, if they've encountered ramen. The book takes us through really a history of empire that from which ramen and ramen culture and the explosion of ramen emerges from the discussions about the connection between MSG and the taste of umami, to the emergence of nighttime dining, to the context of World War II and post-war. Now, there's a wonderful chapter on the World War II context that really shows the ways that the war brought about some really drastic changes that set the stage, as you indicate here, for major transformations in Japanese cuisine. First, it set the stage for the immediate post-war catastrophe that forces people to look for alternatives to a rice-based cuisine. And that really results in, as you mentioned, an explosion of kind of famine and hunger that sets the stage for this. It also removes many of the social divisions that had divided pre-war society. So as part of this story, we see along the way rice and miso soup becoming the kind of markers of Japanese culinary identity throughout the colonies and the empire in a really kind of interesting and oblique way. We see sort of the transformation, so a post-war context where there's a new kind of thinking about Japan's national cuisine. And finally, this brings us to, in Chapter 9, the kind of culmination of this story for the Styrofoam Cup, which is the ways that these ultimately feed into that the emergence of instant ramen. So there's this situation where we're now in the post-war. The Americans are giving all this wheat to Japan. So this one individual that you mentioned becomes the kind of focal point for figuring out the answer to, now, what do we do with all the wheat that the Americans gave us? And that brings us to this story, or the kind of almost conclusion, if not quite the conclusion of the story, of the history of ramen in instant ramen. So can you talk a little bit for us about Ando Momofuku and the emergence of this paradigmatic icon of Japanese culinary culture, or at least in popular culture right now, which is the bowl of instant ramen?
I think this might be the part that most readers and listeners will be at least somewhat familiar, because although strangely, when I first gave a talk about this aspect in Europe, it wasn't until afterwards that someone came up to me and said, "I have no idea what instant ramen is. What were you talking about?"
Wow.
And they're called pot noodles in Europe. Mm-hmm. So I had to suddenly there. I said, "Why couldn't you tell me this at the beginning of my talk? Why did you wait until the very end?" it all come. I mean, one of the reasons that ramen in both its kind of restaurant form and the instant form is the most most purchased, produced foodstuff on Earth at this point is because of this invention that comes after World War II. Now, there's a lot of incorrect information around Ando Momofuku. He's not Taiwanese, as some strange kind of Wikipedia sites and whatnot have him. He was Japanese, but he grew up in part in Taiwan, in Tainan, in the south, because, of course, Taiwan is part of the Japanese Empire. I wish I could have found out a bit more aside from the several different biographies and from his son's book, but he, at the time when I tried to get an interview with him, he wasn't giving that many interviews, and so I kind of had to go with published sources. According to kind of a comparison of those sources, as you mentioned, there is a proliferation of American wheat in Japan because the Americans want to keep the Japanese from starving. They realize that if the Japanese start starving, they're going to go against occupation policy. Communists could take over, they fear, and that's not a good thing. But the problem is the Japanese don't know what to do with all the wheat. The Americans actually go around and try to convince the Japanese to bake bread. That doesn't work so well, and it demonstrates a bit of ignorance on the American part because most Japanese households don't have ovens. But the Japanese loved noodles. And Ando, being from a Chinese area, Taiwan, of Japan, was probably in a better position to understand that than most. And he basically sets himself a task after seemingly somewhat consulting for the Nutrition Bureau, for one of the elements of the Japanese government, to find an antidote to Japanese starvation. All this wheat, what should be done with it? And he's unsuccessful for a long, long time. It's only after about close to 10 years of trial and error that he comes upon a formula for finding a way to keep noodles for long periods of time fresh so that they can be kind of reconstituted with just hot water. And he manages to do this by... Well, I shouldn't necessarily reveal how he manages to do it. I'll let people read it in the book if they're so determined, but he does. And obviously it turns into a massive seller first in Japan, but then, of course, internationally because it's so easy. And secondly, it's what food historians call a platform food. Any taste can be essentially placed on top of it. You might want to think of it as kind of the bagel of the Eastern world. And because of that, it became a great seller, not only in all the local regions in Japan, which had different tastes, but therefore internationally, in the rest of East Asia and South Asia. The reason it's available and becomes popular in America is because of cup noodle, because Ando realized that Americans didn't use the same type of bowls and whatnot and cutlery as in Japan, and therefore they needed its own delivery system. And once he gets over that obstacle, another invention, instant ramen is well on to dominating the world of produced foodstuffs after really the mid-1960s.
Now, the last chapter and the conclusion of the book bring us into what happens thereafter. And there, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, not only in this look at ramen in popular culture do we see ramen as it's being engaged with by comedians, but you also describe museums of ramen, ramen stadiums, including the Ramen Philosophers Hall and the Ramen Academy, which is just fantastic, theme parks, manga, and music. There's wonderful, wonderful accounts here that I think are going to provide fodder for probably many, many projects after this, because it's such an inherently interesting sort of visual and oral and cultural set of phenomena. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about, though, comes, this is perhaps the last thing that I'll ask you, comes in the conclusion where the story kind of looks outward into the kind of future history of what happens as a result of this. And one of the really interesting directions and perhaps unexpected directions for a culinary history that this study points to is a series of environmental issues that emerge from ramen and ramen production in Japan and out and sort of outside of Japan as well. Can you talk a little bit about that, if that's something that that continues to interest you? The sort of what are the increasing global consequences of what seems like a, although ubiquitous, but relatively unproblematic, popular food?
This is the outcome, in a sense, of what happens when A, we don't eat at home, and B, we eat kind of prepackaged food with non-biodegradable delivery systems. And that's really, it's the styrofoam bowl of cup noodle. As more and more Japanese spent more time outside of the house, more time on the go, and more time trying to find quick ways of eating, you know, savory or tasty food, ramen exploded. And they weren't eating it anymore in dishes that one had to wash and keep in the cupboard. They were eating it in large styrofoam bowls that one could just throw away. And that became an enormous issue as the popularity and sales of instant ramen exploded over time. But Japan has also managed some ways to deal with its environmental problems. And if you look at pictures of Tokyo from the 1960s compared to today, it's like night and day. In fact, if you look at pictures from Tokyo in the 1960s, it looks like pictures of Beijing or various parts of Western China now, where it's very hazy and you can't see very far. So I think there's still hope, obviously, for things to change. But the issue really struck me as I begin to dig in on into how big of a seller instant ramen became in China. And being an aficionado of trains in China, and you take these long, well, until recently, one took long-haul journeys before they had the high-speed rail. And, you know, these could last anywhere from 18 to 25 hours. And you would invariably have a bowl or two of instant ramen in your styrofoam bowl. And the train lady would come through, and she'd collect all of it very nicely and sweep, put it in a plastic bag. And then she'd wait. And then when you were in the middle of nowhere, she'd open the side door and throw it out. And I thought, wow, okay. And you know, the Chinese have a word for this. It's called the white trash pollution problem. And it's become a big problem. The Chinese are eating more fast food, and they are enjoying the sales of this Japanese product. And in some ways, this is a consequence that I think no one could have envisioned. What happens when the Chinese begin to enjoy Japanese food in a way that they never did historically? I don't think sushi and sashimi run into such problems, but produced prepackaged food does. And it ties into this other element of exchange of food between Japan and China in other ways. For example, a lot of prepackaged frozen food in Japan is being imported from China. And over the years, some of this food has been found to have been tainted with various chemicals. So as both nations in some ways change the very ways or their concepts of what constitutes a Japanese meal or a Chinese meal and begin to mix and match and share more produced foods, an evolution of environmental degradation has occurred. I think both parties, and they're aware of it in China and Japan. I'm not necessarily sure that they're dealing with it in the same manner, but it is an outgrowth of the way in which we now eat, even though the Japanese continually talk about their healthy lifestyle and the four seasons and the freshness and whatnot. What they often forget, of course, is that instant ramen plays a large role internationally, and in some ways they're responsible for that change.
And I think this is in many ways a perfect note to move to a conclusion on, because it's a great example of not only the ways that this narrative about this seemingly sort of individual object, right, is extraordinarily broad ranging, but also the ways that the history and ethnography that you've offered us here of this bowl of noodles straddles so many different fields and so many different not just academic and sort of historical fields, but also has really wide-ranging ramifications as a story that I think we'll still be seeing the outcomes of in the years to come.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons it was hard to write. I think for the very elements that you described.
So, Barak, now that we've had this discussion, there are so many elements in this book that we didn't even begin to touch on. It's an extraordinarily rich story, and in the space of an hour, there's no way that we covered all of the including some very, very fascinating aspects of this story. Is there anything in particular that we didn't cover, but that you'd especially like to point out for listeners, especially perhaps listeners who haven't yet had a chance to see the book or to read it?
There's no one moment in particular. I did write the book so that each chapter can be used individually. Mm-hmm. And if one is not interested in the early part of the history, then you can skip to the middle or just skip to the last popular history chapter. So it's written in a sense to be easily divided up into 10 different portions like a tasty cake.
Great. So now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on that. What's next for you? What project or projects is or are currently inspiring you at the moment?
Well, I was quite lucky this last year. I think many of us apply for several grants all at the same time, and I happened to hit the mother lode. So I'm finishing a book on Japanese war crimes in China. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at 1945 to 1965. And in a sense, that grows out of ramen. Now, I'm continuing to be interested in what happens to Chinese in Japan and, of course, Japanese in China. I've gone a bit back to the war and the post-war. And that project turned into a much larger project. And I was fortunate to receive a £1.2 million grant that will allow two PhD students and four postdocs to come onto my project, and we're going to look at the dissolution of the Japanese Empire and the search for justice. So looking at East Asia, what happens after the Japanese Empire falls, because I think a lot of time the story has not been told in a post-imperial way, but it immediately moves to a post-war narrative, and the two are a bit different.
Well, congratulations on that. Best of luck with that project, and I'll look forward to talking to you again when that project emerges in book form as well.
I will look forward to that as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Barak.
Cheers.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.